So I have a feeling that is the genesis of your next book?
It is, in fact, this autobiography I'm writing, right. Right, and that's what, those are some of the first notes I took about it.
Is this a real autobiography? Or
it is. It's called Becoming a Man, First Person, What It Was Like to Grow Up Gay. And it is just unhinging me to do. It's the most difficult thing I've ever done.
Why?
Because it's like an emotional detoxification somehow, and talking about all of that pain of being in the closet from the age of 10 to 25. It's like I'm 20 again, and I can't stand it. I can't stand the person I was then. It was like a 15-year nervous breakdown. Anyway, someone should tell that story, and I don't think anybody has.
Well, have you read Martin Duberman's?
I look very forward to reading it. He certainly has given that story a shot for his generation. Remarkable
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
Remarkable figure.
Yeah, I did read the book.
Uh-huh.
I heard him on the radio. I haven't invited him on the broadcast. It's a work of nonfiction.
Right,
it's
right.
Not, I'm not opposed to doing nonfiction books. Uh-huh. But his life wasn't really dramatic.
Uh-huh.
It's not, of course, it's not over yet. But
right.
It wasn't a real dramatic life, but it was a difficult
yeah.
one because
yeah.
It took him a long time to
come
to grips with his homosexuality
yeah.
and to live with it and to let people know that that happens to be the way it was.
Right, exactly. And it's the same kind of thing I'm after in this book as well.
Well, you grew up in an Irish family.
Are we recording?
Yeah.
Oh, I grew up in an Episcopalian family.
Monette sounds
and
so Irish.
My father transferred from French Catholic, and I grew up in a town. I grew up in a town that had a lot of French Catholics and Irish Catholics. So I saw a lot of the ugly rivalry between them.
I guess Monette does have kind of a French feel.
Yeah, yeah. My grandfather was
Monet.
right. My grandfather was. French-Canadian, and he added the T-E and made Monet Monette because he couldn't stand everyone mispronouncing it when he moved to Boston to go to law school. And he had a real problem with the Irish, and Mayor Curley was his big enemy because they were both in politics at the same time. I chose an Irish family for Halfway Home because my lover of 2 years, Stephen Kolzak, had grown up in a family that was half Irish Catholic, half Polish Catholic, and I really wanted to go after the Catholic Church, obviously, but I also wanted to talk about the fury of an Irish household. And when I had first conceived Halfway Home to be about a gay brother and a straight brother, I wanted to find a real ethnic place for them to be.
Mm. Did you grow up in Boston?
I grew up in Andover, Massachusetts, about 20 miles north of Boston.
With a large Irish population?
Yes.
Yeah. I have heard, now I grew up in the Midwest, where everybody was heavily Presbyterian or Methodist or Episcopalian or whatever. Maybe every block had a Jewish family. Not too many Irish, no Italians. It was really kind of a monolithic childhood. But coming to New York, I've talked to people who grew up in New York, and the Irish were tough in the 40s and 50s. I mean, they had street gangs and...
Yeah. Yeah,
I know a lot of I have a lot of Jewish friends who said they were victimized and picked on and beaten
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But I think the Irish are mature. They've gone to the suburbs and they've integrated pretty well with the rest of society.
Indeed.
What was your experience with the Irish growing up in Andover?
My experience of the Irish was that they were still very oppressed by the WASP classes and were, for the most part, mill workers and in the serving trade. And they bore a lot of bitterness. They were very xenophobic and kept to themselves. They were tended to be educated in the parochial schools. And, I mean, I suppose it's a level of defensiveness that made them have great disdain for us Protestants. What I never was able to understood about the Irish toughs that I grew up with was that they could go to Mass every Sunday and be such bullies all the rest of the week. But I suppose that happens in a lot of places besides the Catholic Church. But I saw a lot of the hypocrisy of the Church even growing up. And as soon as I came out as a gay man, I began to see how deeply the hierarchy of that Church had diabolized my people and made us scapegoats for their... tyrannical, sex-phobic rule. And I guess, I mean, I'm classically the kind of person that Cardinal O'Connor would talk of as a Catholic basher, though I would like to at least clarify the difference between the way I feel about a practicing lay Catholic, and I respect everyone's relationship to his God. My quarrel is with the hierarchy of that church, which I believe is a totally political organization and which has had a pogrom against my people for, I don't know, 1,000 years.
Well, it's interesting, while we're on this subject, in Halfway Home, the narrator, the hero of your book, is a man who is a performance artist. And perhaps you can describe him for the listeners.
Yes, I very much wanted to take someone who was in the kind of edges of art. I was very much, I wanted to engage this whole issue of the threat to our First Amendment freedoms and what I call the cultural McCarthyism of the present day. And my hero, Tom Shaheen, is a performance artist, and his performance piece that he does is called Miss Jesus. He does Jesus in drag and talks about Christianity as a gay church, that's what it always, his Jesus says that's what it always was meant to be, that he and the 12 apostles were gay. And it is meant to wrinkle a few collars in the church. Someone said to me, well, is this like what Salman Rushdie was doing with Muslim fundamentalists? And I say, well, maybe the difference is that I don't think he consciously was trying to rile them up. I think I'm consciously trying to rile them up. And yet, I think Tom is a deeply spiritual man. And in a way, the path he goes is a very Christian path in the book. There is an ex-nun in the book who is no longer interested in the church and no longer much interested in God, but she has given her life in service to battered women. And I guess I try, in the same way that Halfway Home tries to be about the difference between the chosen family of a gay man in his adult life and his blood family, and the way the chosen family helps heal the blood family, I guess that blood family is connected to a blood religion that I think of as outmoded and full of hate and fear, and that somehow the people in this book are trying to find a spirituality and an ethics which works for them now.
Well, I have to say that the two scenes in which Tom plays Miss Jesus,
right,
are absolutely hilarious. I mean,
thanks.
I mean, you have to burst out laughing. However, I have to qualify that by saying that some people aren't going to laugh at all if they read those sections. They're going to be extremely angry because
yeah.
It looks like a major indictment of not only religion, but particularly the Christian religion and Jesus in particular.
Well, I think the Jesus of the last 2,000 years has become as much of a hypocritical piece of nonsense as, say, the Reagans in the 80s were. I think the real Jesus would have spent a lot of time with people with AIDS. I think we were his people. I think that the castigated and the oppressed were the very people that appealed to him. I'm not much interested in the Jesus of the Gospels. That's just writing. The Jesus that I perceive deeply within history has a kind of passion and a kind of political temper and a kind of rage in him that appeals very much to me and the AIDS activists with whom I live. People are welcome to whatever Jesus they want. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Have you had any reactions so far?
No, I mean, you know, I think in a way this, in the end, is a book for people who are struggling with AIDS and people who are struggling with gay people in their families. And it's not, I mean, Cardinal O'Connor managed to do a whole diatribe on Uttaranka Heinemann's book without having read it, so I suppose the church could get after this book without having read it. It, you know, the Muslims didn't have to read Salman Rushdie before issuing the death threat.
I might say parenthetically that the Cardinal also blasted Rushdie's book without having read it.
Right, exactly. The not reading is very much how book burnings happen. I think we have to remember that the first book burning that the Nazis did was of the gay and lesbian archives. And it's hard to know, you know, one becomes very paranoid, but it's hard to know exactly where the cultural McCarthyism is coming from and where and what it is they're trying to stop. When I grew up, Don, you couldn't get Tropic of Cancer, you couldn't get Lady Chatterley's Lover. I could barely get The Catcher in the Rye. I mean, I lived in a small town. The libraries kept those books away from me. You couldn't even get some of these books in this country. I think we're coming back to a place like that.
You really think,
yeah,
think so?
I mean, I do.
We're so persistent about maintaining our First Amendment rights that I just...
Well, I think there's a fight going on.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that the you know, the good may yet win. But, you know, I saw Poison last night, which I thought was a great and brilliant film. And though erotic and political in many ways, the idea that anyone could find that pornographic is so stunning to me. You know, what has happened in this country is we have developed this sitcom, nice guy, morning in America view of ourselves, which is in fact xenophobic and jingoistic and not true to what the country really looks like. And so our real individuality and our eccentricity and our feistiness are all blanded out by the programmed sound bites that we're supposed to believe about ourselves as Americans. And most of the right-wing think tanks now have cultural wings. And they don't have Russia to fight anymore. They want to fight the enemy within. That's why I feel it as a kind of McCarthyism, you know.
Well, it's something we all have to fight.
I mean, I haven't
had... Most of us in journalism have been fighting for our freedom to speak for years, and many journalists have gone to prison or jail for that.
Right,
and it's a constant battle, and it usually it starts on a very low level, you know, local school boards, and things like that.
Right.
Now, once again, in your new novel, Halfway Home, your hero Tom is a victim of AIDS, so that is in a way kind of an unlikely hero, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose the most unlikely thing about this book is that it is as happy as it is. If you had told me that I was going to write a book about AIDS that would be about joy a few years ago, I would have told you that you were crazy. But it happens that this book is about a man who, on the tightrope between life and death, decides to risk love. And it's about the love that he's able to wrestle from his brother, and the love he feels for his nephew, and the love he feels for the man who becomes his lover. So he gets it from three different places because he is open to it. The older I get, I'm 45, the more I understand how difficult intimacy is. One of the things that we are kept from understanding in a society which is so sex-phobic and which doesn't teach us anything about passion is that it doesn't teach us what passion is for. We're told that it's all about this, it's all about procreation and the American Family Association. In fact, I think what passion is for is intimacy. And it's very difficult to learn intimacy, it's very difficult to teach it. It's as difficult for straight people as it is for gay people. I wanted to write a book where the struggle for intimacy would work. And that's, I hope it does.
It does indeed, but one thing that is very disturbing is the fact that that Tom does eventually have sex with Gray. Now, Gray does not have AIDS. Tom does. Now, this seems to be a very high-risk activity.
I don't think they engage in any specific high-risk behavior because of having oral sex, but it certainly is a quarrel in the community. Since I believe that saliva destroys the virus, I think that oral sex is safe between a seronegative and a seropositive person. If one were going to have intercourse, one would have to use a condom, and I assume that they have intercourse, which I don't know whether they have in this novel or not.
No, they don't have intercourse per se, but there are two scenes in which they have oral sex, one of which Gray has an orgasm. And the fact that Gray had the orgasm, Tom did not, may ameliorate the problem, but still, you worry about it.
Well, I mean, I mean for people to worry about it. I really want to raise the issue. I mean, I think we can all talk about safe sex as academically as we want. The fact is that the sexual urge is an extremely difficult thing to control, and we are getting nowhere in controlling it, and that's why we have a generation of teenagers at risk for AIDS. So I wanted to bring up all that issue about the fact that when people who are upfront about being seropositive or are having AIDS are negotiating intimacy with someone who is not. It is a negotiation. There is an actual negotiation that has to take place. And it's a strange thing that has happened to sex in the modern age. But everyone has to do that negotiation now. Anyone who is not doing that negotiation is flying by the seat of his pants. I mean, I always say that among the 2 million people who are infected with AIDS in this country, there's easily 250,000 straight men, bisexual men, who are notoriously lie about their contacts with men and have sex with women regularly. And the women who have sex with those men are at great risk, and they need to be protecting themselves. They need to be having these negotiations. We always say that anybody you sleep with, you are sleeping with everybody they've ever slept with. And it's a great undercurrent of anxiety and dread, I think, that has become the ground of the sexual dance between men and women, as well as between men and men, or women and women. There was an article in the New York Times about how the divorce rate is finally beginning to taper off because people are so afraid of being out there single in a world of AIDS.
Well, the AIDS epidemic has been so devastating within the gay community that, in your own case, your most intimate friends have died.
Well, I do think I've probably buried 50 or 75 people, including two lovers. There was a moment when I wrote...
Excuse me, just one second.
Sure.
I want to get you a little closer. Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Myself, I've buried 50 or 75 people. There was a moment last September when I buried Stephen. He died unexpectedly and suddenly. I had finished the book about him a month before. And I buried him, and I put the ground over his urn, and I asked everybody to leave me alone, and I talked to him for a moment. And then I walked down 10 feet to where Roger was buried, and I talked to him for a moment. And I realized that having buried two lovers, there was really no one could tell me how to live my life anymore. There was really no one I could take advice from anymore. I would either survive this grief or not. I would either make some kind of life that made sense for me before it took me or not. But that was my quest. I just had to do it. I'm glad that I was able to record in Halfway Home the joy of my relationship with Stephen. We knew that one of us would bury the other one. I don't know how gloomy about my own life I am. I'm amazed that I've been able to write these four books about AIDS.
Now, just to clarify this, is Stephen the prototype for Tom?
Yes, Stephen is Tommy. Yeah, I really wanted to write a kind of portrait of this man that I had come to love so much. So that the man he falls in love with in the book, Gray, who's a kind of quieter figure, kind of a sort of professorial figure, that's me. I mean, you know, I believe also, along with Bovary, I mean, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. You're every character in a book, or as Gore Vidal says, we each have a small cast of characters and we tend to dress them up in different clothes, and they're all pieces of ourselves. But, yeah, I think this novel is my love poem to Stevie, definitely. And since then, nothing is quite the same. I wish I could be as happy as the characters are in this book. I am on a good day.
On a good day.
Yeah.
You're talking about your own affliction with
right.
AIDS. Because
right.
I remember the last time we spoke, you had mentioned that you were working with a great sense of urgency that every day or every week might be your last.
You can't work with that urgency without kind of breaking down from exhaustion. You have to take breaks from that. I still feel the urgency, but I may feel less the need to write about it than have a sense of how I want to live the rest of my life. Happily, I've been on good medication and have not broken through with full-blown AIDS yet. But
is that the ATZ?
AZT is one of the drugs I've been on. I've been on it for 3 years, and I'm on a combination of that and DDI. It certainly must be unique to the times we live in that I, as an author, can talk about my drug regimen as I talk about my book. Well,
you are your book.
I am my book, and we now have a literature of AIDS. I mean, you know, you realize we began to have a literature of Vietnam as the war went on, and then a kind of explosion at the end. Someone asked me how I thought that AIDS had changed the arts. Well, there's no question in my mind that some of the greatest art that's being produced now is about AIDS, and that so much of the rest of the art of the last 10 years is about nothing. You know, a lot of the art of the Reagan 80s is about people getting their next show at a gallery and people publishing their next book and their next big advance. And Eastern Europeans have said to me for years, why do American writers write about nothing? And meaning, why aren't they more political? And why aren't they more, you know, why don't they more engage the powers? Well, that's not the kind of people we necessarily are. In the AIDS crisis, we're certainly that kind of writers.
But I don't see your books as real political books. I think you've outlined the problem and you have approached it so that we feel emotionally for the people. I didn't feel a sense of outrage so much,
mm-hmm.
But I felt a sense of disappointment and sadness,
mm-hmm.
in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where you have worked best by appealing is not a good word, but by hitting our emotions.
Right. Well, happily.
And making us feel.
Happily for me, Don, I write love stories, and it's always what I've liked to do. It's always what I've wanted to do. It has been out of fashion during a lot of my writing career, but that hasn't bothered me too much. When I think of a great novel, I think of a novel like Emma, and you meet Mr. Knightley and Emma at the beginning, and they're these two wonderful characters, and you love them, and they don't know that they love each other yet, and you spend a couple of hundred pages of them haltingly coming towards one another. That is my view of a great love story somehow, and there really is a sense of happily ever after at the end of Jane Austen, and yet you really believe that they've opened their hearts to one another in the process. I think American writers have tended to write about love very ironically and with a sort of sense of removal and a sense of not quite believing it, you know, and I'm a full-bore romantic, and I do believe in it, so...
I think your potential readers should know that in Halfway Home, this is not just a gay novel. But there's a real story. It's a melodrama as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
There's a real story. You've got death. You've got the mob. You've got the bomb explosion.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a plot. I mean, there's a real plot here and it's built around a gay man and his new lover. But there's a story here. It's a mystery.
Right.
As well.
Right. 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 I mean, who knows whether there is a queer sensibility to the fiction? I hope, but the sense that my sensibility is very passionate and very engaging, and that you know, nothing would please me more than that the Strait brothers, that this whole book is also about, would be able to read a book like this too, because I think that there is so much conflict between gay and straight siblings. I think it has torn a lot of families apart. And a lot of people don't know how to heal that rift. Tragically, AIDS has to be used to heal the rift here, but the rift. And I think it's, in that sense, I think it's a happy book, because I think gay and straight really come to understand and love one another in this book.
And as I said, a funny book. But your intended audience is not gays per se. It's for anybody who feels and wants to know not only more about the people who have AIDS, but just about things, life. I mean, that's what books do for us. Novels, fiction, they tell us things that you can't find anyplace else.
Right, and fiction is something.
Is that true? I mean,
well, certainly fiction is something that's truer than truth when we really want to find out how people feel.
But in terms of your audience,
yes,
you're not.
I mean,
is not restricted to Christopher Street.
Not at all. I mean, I don't want it to be. My ideal audience, I suppose, in my own heart, is the 16 or 17 year old boy that I was, who had nothing to read about himself. But after all, I've been reading novels by straight authors my whole life, and I didn't need a lexicon to read them. I mean, I learned an enormous amount about passion from D.H. Lawrence or John Updike, or you know, you name it, and I didn't feel I needed a special dispensation to enter their worlds, and they shouldn't feel a special dispensation to enter my world. You know, I think that the great fight of our society, of our churning society in the next decade, is going to be about pluralism, and you know, how do we include each other, and. I'm very excited when I read a novel about African Americans or Native Americans or Asian Americans. I mean, I learned an enormous amount when I read Chinamen. You know, get to become other people and be in their world, and it's really exhilarating. I mean, that's because I seek exhilaration from fiction. You know,
well, there's an interesting aspect in Halfway Home in which Tom, in a way, is trying to become a role model for his nephew, who's, what, about seven?
Right,
Or so. And the boy's mother, of course, is outraged. Because she's afraid, obviously, that Tom is going to twist her son and make him into a gay.
Right.
And this reminds me of a gubernatorial candidate who lost in New Jersey last year, who wanted to ban from the school system any teacher who happened to be gay.
Mm-hmm.
Why? he didn't really make it clear exactly why, but the impression was that a school teacher who is gay would have an undue influence on the students and may even prey upon them.
Right.
The fact of the matter is, as I understand by from what I've read and seeing the statistics, if children are abused, it's usually heterosexuals who abuse children.
The figures are something like 90-10.
Then why not ban heterosexuals from the school?
Well, yeah.
That much logic, doesn't it?
That's as much logic as it has. I mean, to make gay and lesbian people the scapegoat out of that homophobia, remember, is hatred and fear, and the fear is really what's there more often than not. I think that one of the things we are deeply afraid of in this culture is to confront how dysfunctional our families, this traditional American family, is, how much child abuse there is. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross says that 27% of her patients have had incest. 27%. Well, you know, we really have some problems out there, and we really need to begin to talk about them. And the problem is not that there may be a gay teacher in a school. I take the essentialist posture about being gay. I think there have always been gay people. I think that it is a particular kind of spirit and personality. I think we have been the shaman figures, the teaching figures, the nurse figures in cultures all over the world. You see this in Polynesia, you see it in Africa, you see it in American Indian tribes. And we have a very special role as citizens and as people, and I think we have a very loving role. It's not that we're not capable of child abuse, and, you know, we're capable of every awful thing, but not because we're gay, partly because we're oppressed, I think.
Paul, you're not a doctor, so you don't have to really comment on this in an authoritative way, but just where do you think this disease is going to go? Do you think it's going to ebb at some point, or maybe it has?
Well, no, I think that there's going to be a horrendous increase in cases in the next couple of years, and we've lost 115,000 people in this country to it now, and we expect to lose 200,000 or 300,000 more in the next 3 years. That will mean, I believe, that every family in America will basically have lost someone to AIDS. I do have some hope that the antiviral drugs that we have in online now, along with the next generation of antiviral drugs, which are called the blockers, when that is all in place, we should be able to manage the AIDS virus as a chronic manageable infection. We're a few years away from that. Those of us who are well-connected and fighters are having some of those drugs now in crude form. I don't know whether I can stay ahead of the wave that long. I know that I've stayed alive for 4 years since my own HIV serostatus was known to me because of antiviral medication. I think by the millennium we will have made advances that we can keep people alive, but we have no system for helping people or for delivering medication to people, and it is, after all, a worldwide crisis as well. So I'm afraid we, sadly enough, after the first decade of the calamity, we've only seen the tip of the iceberg. There are wonderful people working bravely on it all over the world, but not, unhappily, in our government.
You know, a year or two ago, I was talking to Edmund White, who told me that he did not have AIDS, did not expect to get AIDS, and was being extremely careful. And I just saw an article in the newspaper just a few weeks ago that he now has AIDS and is trying to come to grips with it.
I don't know. You know, Edmund and I would, in a way, have probably disagreed philosophically with what it means to say you have the virus. I always say that the virus is not just never discriminates between pre-AIDS and AIDS and dying of AIDS. He may still be in a place where I am that he hasn't broken through with an infection, but he may have taken a political stance in which he realizes, I have HIV. This is a spectrum of a situation for 10 or 15 years. And
well, apparently he thought he wasn't going to get it, and apparently he must have somehow gotten it a long time ago, and it's just coming to the surface.
Yeah. Well, I think what might be coming to the surface for him, he's a brave and remarkable man, what might be coming to the surface for him is a sense of being seropositive means that you are there. I hope to be seropositive and not sick for years to come, Don, but I don't know. I mean, I could wake up tomorrow morning with a lymphoma. It's a tightrope that I walk, you know.
Well, not only that, any of us, well, I understand the odds are worse with regard to you because of AIDS. But we all face that problem. I'm several years older than you are, and I'm approaching heart attack country. By the same time, I live in a big city where I have to dodge buses and trucks every day. I mean,
right.
We just don't know.
Right,
we just
right.
don't know.
And you can't live with death an inch from your face. It's somehow we, you know, Ernst Becker says in The Denial of Death, if we didn't have a denial of death, we couldn't get up in the morning and make a cup of coffee. So I have aspects of positive denial in me. That's why I was able to write a happy book. I mean, that's why I've been able to engage in a new relationship again. It's harrowing and scary, but on the other hand, I believe that to love and to work is to define my life. That's what I always wanted to be able to do. During the 15 years I was in the closet, I could neither love nor work. And now it's terribly important for me to be able to do both of them.
Well, Paul Manette, you're a wonderful, wonderful writer, certainly one of our best, and you're doing a wonderful thing in writing these novels and telling us the way things are. It's very important that you do that. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Don. Thanks for your support, and I mean it.